Welcome to Bread and Roses. I'm your host, Leanne Kranz. Tonight we're talking about the princess icon and its unique grip on the imaginations of girls across generations. From ancient folklore to recent Disney films, fairy tales are among the first stories we tell our children, as we were told. Folklorists caution that these stories have never been merely entertainment, but powerful mechanisms for imparting culturally approved roles and behaviors, for maintaining the stability of societies. To this day, the princess remains the most celebrated and influential female character in these tales. We continue to pass down these stories, but the gap is ever widening between the fantasy presented and the reality of the modern world. Tonight, we'll look at the messages we're sending our youngest girls about themselves, other females, men, marriage, dreams, and destiny, and what these heroines are sacrificing along the way. With me in the studio tonight is Bread and Roses Collective member, Molly Mayo.
Hello.
Hello. She's our resident expert on this country's own princess icon, Miss America. She's prepared a multimedia piece that she'll introduce later in the show. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
And our guest tonight, all the way from Austin, Texas, is Suzanne Marie Fenger, a former early childhood educator, now involved in the study of social aggression among preschool-age girls. She was my guest back in January, and we're just so happy to have her here tonight to discuss this related topic of princesses. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Leanne.
Why don't you tell us how you first made the connection between social aggression and the current princess craze among preschool-age girls?
Well, the values and culture that cause social aggression amongst girls are reinforced and celebrated in tales of princesses. As a former preschool teacher, I noticed that our 4 and 5-year-olds were finding extremely subtle ways to be mean. They were choosing social aggression already. Let me define social aggression briefly. Social aggression is using subtle, nonviolent means to aggress against others. Exclusion, gossip, rumor spreading. In preschools, this is, you can't come to my birthday party if you don't play the game my way. Or, those shoes are for babies. In short, social aggression happens because our girls are taught from birth to be nice, to take care of others, to never get angry. So they are left with the option of social aggression. While studying this, I noticed that Disney princesses were particularly powerful figures in Little Girl World. The same values that bring about social aggression are an integral part of the world of the princess.
You know, all of us around this table were raised on princesses, as were many of our listeners. Yet it now seems to be a burgeoning trend. So what's going on with this?
Well, a number of years ago, the Disney Corporation hit on a brilliant idea of marketing all of the heroines from their most popular stories together in one big happy package. They put together the classic Disney princesses of our mother's or even grandmother's childhoods. They put together Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, and Cinderella with some more modern heroines. Jasmine from the story of Aladdin, Ariel from The Little Mermaid, Belle from Beauty and the Beast, Pocahontas and Mulan, and labeled them all as Disney princesses. In this way, they managed to, without actually creating a new product, come up with a whole series of new things to sell.
Mm-hmm. You know, everywhere I look these days, I see little girls swathed in pink, and on their shirts they have the Trinity of Princesses.
Yes, yes, Belle, Sleeping Beauty, and Cinderella. Mm-hmm. And Disney, because of their hugeness, is able to reinforce the princesses in every sector. There are theme parks where you can visit the princesses. You can hear the princess songs on the radio. You can go to the Disney Princess website. You can wear princess clothing. You can buy princess furniture.
Mm.
And they actually do say that they're hoping in this year, in the year 2006, to be the number one global girls franchise.
Yes, this is on the Disney marketing website. They say that they have 95% universal awareness among moms and kids. That's instant recognition.
Everybody knows who the Disney princesses are. Mm-hmm. And on their website, you can visit all of the princesses and learn more about them. And to kind of start us off this evening and sort of show you where these princesses are coming from and who they are, I wanted to read a short bit about who Cinderella is, as she is the most recognized Disney princess. Although gentle and soft-spoken, she has a keen, intelligent sense of humor, which she wisely keeps hidden from her cruel stepmother and jealous stepsisters. Finding delight in her tiny animal friends and able to sing as she works, Cinderella has true dignity, something her stepsisters could learn a thing or two about. Despite moments of heartbreak and disappointment, Cinderella holds on to her hopes until goodness and beauty are rewarded and dreams that she's dreamed do come true.
I took the princess quiz, what princess am I most like? And it was Sleeping Beauty. It cautioned me not to dream my life away.
Are those from the Disney website?
It's straight from the horse's mouth.
Self-described that way.
Yes.
Wow.
So it's important to remember, people, that most American children are brought up on these Disney films. And the trend is obviously spreading across the globe. And these children are exposed at such a tender age. So let's examine what these princesses are teaching our young girls.
Well, first, I think we should talk about looks, being one of the most obvious things that we see when we look at all of the Disney princesses. They are all beautiful
and skinny,
and they wear such nice clothes.
Tiny feet.
Pretty dresses.
You know, one of the princesses, Belle, you know, her name means beauty.
Yes, yeah. And they, besides focusing on what they look like in the animation sequences, they actually talk about how important beauty is as well. In The Little Mermaid, if you're not familiar with the story, oh, how could that be? Mm-hmm. Ariel decides to give up her voice, and she is a singer. Singing is her favorite thing, it appears.
It's a special talent.
Yes. She agrees to give up her voice in exchange for legs, because what she really wants is to be a part of the human world so that she can be with Prince Eric, whom she's not actually ever met.
Or talked with.
No, no. And she makes a bargain with the villainess, Ursula the Sea Witch. And in singing about the bargain that she's made to give up her voice in exchange for legs, Ursula sings, "You don't need your voice. You've got looks, pretty face, body language. Men up there don't like a lot of blather. Much preferred for ladies not to say a word. Gentlemen avoid conversation when they can. Fawn on lady who's withdrawn. She who holds her tongue gets her man."
Wow. So, beauty and silence. Also, in Mulan, there was a nice little ditty about a song about how to be a good wife, and silence was one of the key phrases there.
As long as you're pretty, that works out just well. I think that these values that are being promoted, if you can call looks a value, are already coming across to our children. In my preschool last year, a number of girls were playing princesses, and there was a girl who was mildly disfigured in the group, and she is bright and interesting and funny and a fabulous player, always full of ideas. And she was told upon approaching the group, "You can't play. You don't look like a princess."
Ooh.
Yeah. More frequently, you just can't play because you're wearing pants.
I mean, and you think about it, that measuring stick could be applied to anyone. Nobody looks like a princess. And it's just very sad and scary that is a standard that's already in place in our preschool classrooms.
Yeah, in many ways, the princesses are upholding an ideal of a perfect girl that, as we all know, is not attainable unless you are animated and drawn by somebody.
A guy. You know, and the little girls are policing each other in the classroom, and girls, I think, are also kind of self-selecting out of that. Like, I don't look like that. I could never look like that. Therefore, what does that mean for my future, my happily ever after? You know, because beauty is that key, that linchpin to the happy ending. Yes. Very mm-hmm. interesting. You know, just on a funny aside, you know, body image is key into all this, and I'm sure we'll get into that with our Miss America piece coming up. But Cinderella is a beautiful princess before she's a princess. She's a beautiful woman by these standards. And when she, however, becomes a princess and the wand is waved and she gets into the beautiful dress and the glass slippers, I noticed her waist shrank in half. She wasn't quite beautiful enough. An inch wasn't good, half an inch better.
At least not for a fancy party.
Exactly. So beauty is the primary avenue that these princesses are winning their prince. Scary. Another interesting point to make, aside from beauty, is that these films are rated G. They are considered safe for children. In fact, children are watching them unsupervised. You know, these tapes seem to be in everybody's home library now. They're looking at them 20 times at least. And women are depicted in very sexually suggestive ways.
Yeah, one of the major changes between the early Disney princesses, the ones done in the 30s through the 50s, Sleeping mm-hmm. Beauty, Snow White, and Cinderella, to the modern princesses, is that they have been, sort of their bodies have changed. The teenagers of the 30s and to the 50s have grown into these buxom women of the 80s and 90s, and the bodies and the clothing styles have changed to much more suggestive and sexualized ones.
Yes, you know, Pocahontas pretty much has an off-the-shoulder buckskin sundress that seems to shrink in length depending on what's going on.
Oh my gosh.
And she has a heaving bosom, shall we say. Ariel, the mermaid, spends the whole movie in a bikini top and then like these low rider fins that dip down way in front. And her main focus throughout the film is to seduce a man, a human man. Jasmine in the film Aladdin wears a two-piece harem outfit, not even close to what real Arab women wear or any other of the female characters in that movie.
And Jasmine also uses sexuality and flirtation as her device towards power. There are numerous scenes where she flirts with the villain or is coy in a way to get what she wants. And this is something that you'll see in a number of the modern Disney films.
And the male characters are never shown this way.
No. No. And it leads to very small children pretending to sit on rocks and kind of slithering around, wearing mermaid costumes, singing to attract imaginary princes. Yes, they really do pretend that. All right, totally changing topics for a moment. Before we move on, we have to take a slight side trip to visit how various races are portrayed in the Disney princess movies.
Yes, again, these are messages we're passing down to our children. And one of the most confusing messages that we're passing down occurs in Pocahontas, I would say. The children are initially presented with the set of good guys, the white male heroes, blue-eyed, blonde hair, and it's obvious that children are supposed to look to them for the action. However, these men soon begin to sing what I would call a manifest destiny anthem as they board the ship for the New World. And then, less than 5 minutes into the film, we hear the beautiful word of savage to depict these indigenous humans. And the song continues on as they all sing about all the fun they've had Indian killing in the last mission, and now they're going to do it again, and they're all back together. They behead a broom after sticking a feather in it to depict an Indian. They behead it, and then they shove their sword in a cask of wine, and it, you know, spills out onto the deck. So that's very confusing for a child. Suzanne, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think that as adults, we can look at a scene like that mm-hmm. where the good guys are doing something that we know they're wrong, and we know they shouldn't really think this. But as adults, we can say, well, the good guy is saying this because he believes it now, but we know he's wrong. And he's going to find out later he's wrong. He's going to be enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
But 4-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds, they're not capable of that level of cognitive detail to a small child, the good guys are right and the bad guys are wrong. There is very little black and white as they're trying to sort out the world. So to see who has already, within the opening 2 minutes, been portrayed as clearly, oh, yeah, that's the hero. You can tell. You know, pretending to kill an Indian and talking about how many more Indians they're going to kill is sanctioning it in the eyes of a small child and showing the child that because they think that, there must be a reason.
Mm-hmm. And tying back into the topic of beauty and sexuality, these women of color in these Disney films where you have Pocahontas, the indigenous character, we have Mulan, the Asian character, Jasmine, the Arab character, these Mulan, not so much, but definitely Pocahontas and Jasmine, these are portrayed as, you know, the exotic, erotic women of color. We're looking at them through the colonialist, male, oppressor's lens, if you will. And the message there is these women are not quite us. They're others, you know, and they're there for our enjoyment, shall we say.
And an incorrect viewpoint as well. You know, Leanne and I were talking about how the culture that Pocahontas came from was, in fact, matrilineal and not a patrilineal culture. If you've ever seen the story, the chief of the Indians makes all the decisions and is kind of the boss of everybody.
And he's telling her she must marry the male that he chose for her.
Yeah. And they're also, when they sit in council, it is an entirely male-based thing. I think that this is a perfect illustration of how Disney changes either the original fairy tale or, in this case, the historical fact of the situation, which is that it was a matrilineal society, so the women would have held a lot of power in Pocahontas' real world, into whatever they want it to be. They really do tailor the story to get their point across.
That white normative view.
Slightly conservative, I'd say, as well.
And say it's conservative is a real understatement, you know, like 14th century ideals. But anyway, I digress. So again, people, these are projected as female stories. These are the stories that we are given, you know, to learn about ourselves as women, as little girls, and our futures. But when you crack into these tales, it's a male-centered world.
Yeah, there's a humongous lack of male characters in these stories.
Female.
Female characters, sorry, not male characters. The world seems to revolve around men in all of these Disney princess stories. In many of them, the princess is almost the only female character that has a name and actually has speaking lines. It's just assumed that the men have the most power and are the most present. And the only, there are almost never mothers, and the females rarely have friends that are human, much less female friends. Female friends are notably absent. And so other than these unrealistically portrayed princesses, there are very few models that the girls can look at and either model themselves on or learn behaviors from.
Right. I mean, they're surrounded by squirrels and birds, but they have really no human support network at all. The mothers have either been killed off, they're not mentioned. Sometimes they're in the scene, but for instance, Sleeping Beauty has a mother, but she is unnamed. Mulan has a mother and a grandmother, but they're very much in line with the father's wishes. They really support what the father wants. And so in this male-centered world, princesses put their fathers at the center of their lives. Or if it's not the father, it's the prince.
Yes, yeah. And in these male-centered worlds, there tend to be three types of female characters that are seen in all of these films. There's the ingenue, the princess. There's the evil woman in her prime. And there's the grandmotherly figure.
Right. These grandmotherly figures, unfortunately, are not human.
That's true.
Pocahontas had a grandmotherly tree that gave her, frankly, pretty bad advice. For instance, the grandmother tree said, Captain John Smith has a good soul, though he is an Indian killer. Okay. Also, these grandmothers in the form of the fairy, if they come in the form of the fairy godmother, you know, they might have some power, you know, but it's interesting. They're depicted as kind of bumbling, fumbling, foolish grandmothers who forget their spells and...
they can't even make a cake.
Yes. So, in a sense, it's like the only the only female characters with power, it's seen as evil power or an incompetent power.
Yes.
So there's really, yeah, the messages are quite mixed.
And that evil power tends to be these women who are, you know, older than 17 but still in their prime, mm-hmm. and villainesses.
Exactly. And so the message is, you know, power is negative in the hands of women. In that, you know, with these evil stepmothers, and it's like powerful women will destroy you and your children. You know, that's this message. There's no celebration at all of women in their prime. You know, their wisdom, their maturity, anything that they can add. It's always that these villainous, powerful women are looking at these princesses as their rivals. Because, again, through in this male-centered world, through this male-centered lens, it's all about beauty. So if I'm in my prime, I'm supposedly not as beautiful as I was when I was young. I'm losing my beauty, therefore I'm losing my power.
And I'm willing to kill for it.
Yes, and I'm willing to kill my rival for it, because it's all about maintaining power in a man's world. So... that's misogyny, flat-out misogyny. Another misogynist that makes an appearance is Grumpy the Dwarf. Might as well be Grumpy the Misogynist. Here's some quotes. All women are poison, full of wicked wiles. And one of the dwarves asks him, what's a wicked wile? And he goes, I don't know, but I'm agin 'em.
And in Mulan, one of the warriors that she is training with says, I don't squeal like a girl. And I think that the presence of these anti-female viewpoints in a supposedly pro-female story is very confusing to young children. Simply by showing the viewpoints that see girls and women in a negative light, even if it's later proved wrong, we're validating it as a possible outlook. We're teaching our children that it does exist. If someone thinks that, there must be a reason. And there is no corresponding insulting language towards males.
Interesting. So these stories are clearly, I feel, divisive to female relationships and friendships. There are no models for positive relationships. We're seen as rivals and competition. I don't think I have to explain how that manifests in the real world to anyone out there, to anybody out there. I'd like to touch on a few other messages that these films are giving to our young children, boys included. Within these films, there are many examples of men manhandling women, so to speak. We have the princess trying to leave the scene with the clock striking midnight, for instance, and the princess grabbing her hand repeatedly, not letting her leave. Captain John Smith tells Pocahontas, you're not leaving, when she hears the drums and tries to go home. There are also lots of men threatening women. Jafar in Aladdin tells Jasmine, I'll teach you some respect, and threatens to backhand her. The Beast in Beauty and the Beast basically keeps Belle as his prisoner and says, you will join me for dinner. She eats with me or she starves. There are lots of examples of fathers yelling at their daughters. You know, Titan, the king of the sea, screams at his daughter, Jasmine, and then destroys everything in her room. Destroys everything in her room. Men are constantly being advised by other men, whether it's advisors or, you know, associates. They're advised by other men how to keep their women in place, okay? Keep them under control.
And I think that, once again, all of these different ideas, although we as the viewer can see them and say, oh, that's the villain, oh, that's bad, merely by the presence of these lines and these behaviors in the movies, we are teaching people and teaching our young children that some people do think this, and
It's normalizing a lot of aggressive behavior toward women. And mm-hmm. little boys are seeing this, and little girls are seeing this.
Yes.
For instance, when Belle in Beauty and the Beast rejects one of her suitors, Gaston, his ardor turns to anger. He says, "I'll have her as my wife," and spends, you know, the rest of the movie plotting that. And women are constantly depicted as commodities. For instance, the prince in the Cinderella story, his father, the king, bellows, "If the shoe fits, bring her in. She will be the prince's bride." We have princesses that are being betrothed at birth. Two fathers are toasting to the unification of two families. So these women are breeder units or wives. And finally, much female behavior is linked to the honor of the family. And in light of the honor killings that are happening throughout the world, where it's legally sanctioned for male relatives to kill their female relatives to cleanse the family name, you know, these are serious messages that we're passing down with some real world implications. I want to remind everybody that you're listening to KBOO, Bread and Roses. I'm Leanne Kranz, and my guest tonight is Suzanne Marie Fanger, former early childhood educator studying social aggression among preschool age girls. And tonight we're talking about how social aggression is linked to many of the princess stories that we are teaching our youngsters.
Well, we've talked about the looks and male-centered world that these princesses are living in. I want to talk a little bit more about who these princesses are. What are their goals, their dreams, and their wishes? Because these are recurring themes in all of the movies. What's going to happen to the princess next? In general, the princesses are extremely passive. They rarely take action or do anything. They are typified by sort of sitting around waiting for something to happen. When the early princesses are so passive that they actually say things like, "They're wishing for the one I love to find me," and that's Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, who wants someone to find me and bring back a love song to me. So they're the only things that they're hoping for, the only things that they are expressing that they would like from life, are not only just finding a partner, but having that partner find them while they stay where they are.
While they're in their coma.
Exactly. So most of the language around the heroine's actions and goals is couched as dreams and wishes. The Cinderella's classic line is, "A dream is a wish your heart makes when you're fast asleep." And all the original princesses, as far as I can tell, really only are looking for a husband, mm-hmm. which makes sense given the time. But the modern princesses seem to be more ambitious, but even they have very undefined goals and plans. Belle wants something more than this provincial town. More is a rather obscure goal.
Mm-hmm.
Jasmine can't have her life lived for her, but never actually says what life she wants. And Pocahontas, well, she dreams about a spinning arrow and believes that her future and her goals will be determined when she figures out the meaning of the dream, but it's about a spinning arrow, which is also
vague.
Pretty vague, mm-hmm. yeah. And I have to say that kind of the ultimate expression of the goals and ambitions and what these princesses do because they're so passive happens in the classroom. Princess games are pretty much the most boring thing that preschoolers ever do. You just can't play princesses because nothing happens. Which is why it involves changing clothing a lot, because that's an actual action. But games always disintegrate after about 5 minutes because you've sort of sat on your divan for a while, you've changed your clothes, you've sat on a tufted cushion, and then what do you do besides, well, if you're at the end, you have a wedding.
Yeah, and because these stories depend on some sort of outside agent to come in and make the happy ending happen, whether it's the wave of the wand or the heroic deed of the prince.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the princesses, they may have goals and dreams, however undefined, but they give them up for others and are taught to sacrifice what you want or what you need, and that is noble, to subvert your own needs for the needs of others.
Mm-hmm.
The most tragic example being Mulan's line, "If I was truly to be myself, I would break my family's heart. I can't hide who I am, though I've tried." And Mulan is a fabulous character. She is smart. She is inventive. She's
courageous.
Brave.
Yeah,
she's strong. But yet she is sacrificing herself and trying to hide who she is.
And, Belle has these dreams of, she loves to read and she seeks adventure. But at the very first opportunity, when her father is captured, she sacrifices herself. She's literally sacrificing her freedom for the rest of her life to save her father's life.
Yeah. Ariel gives up her voice for a guy she's never spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
That's a rather concrete example of loss of voice.
Mm-hmm.
And this does manifest in our girls and is connected to what the American culture tends to teach our girls from a very early age, that we should take care of others' needs before our own. I very frequently see girls who are perfectly willing at the age of 3 to give up a favorite toy when somebody else asks for it or takes it out of their hands, and they try to brush it off and say, "Oh, no, I was done with that. I don't want it." Well, they would say that in a 3-year-old way, but
mm-hmm.
they express that they are finished with it and don't want it anymore, even though you can see in their faces this longing for the thing that they had loved playing with.
And again, I just want to point out that, these movies have very mixed messages. Some of these values and traits aren't necessarily bad. It's just that little girls, unfortunately, are paying the tab in our society. They're always sacrificing, or they're being pressured to always do these certain things that ends up denying their own autonomy or their own functioning humanity.
We all want to teach our children to take care of others and to be respectful.
Sure.
But to do it at the price of yourself and who you are.
And if boys aren't taught the same thing in the same way, it's an imbalance.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And an interesting thing that comes of this is that in the new Disney stories, as I said, the old ones, the heroines were very passive. They did very little. They sat around waiting for people and did what other people told them. The new Disney stories, the new breed of Disney princess, as Disney terms it, does go out and seek for something more. And in the end, she always regrets it. Every single one of the modern Disney princesses expresses extreme regret for her big moment of action. And in many cases, she's regretting something that could not have been avoided. Belle says, "This is all my fault. If only I'd gotten here sooner," when there really was no way she could have gotten there sooner. She was a captive. Mulan, I should never have left home. Pocahontas, all this happened because of me. These stories enculturate our girls to believe that they're not necessarily great decision makers and to feel fear and guilt. So when you do go ahead and make these rash decisions, you're probably going to screw it up.
Yeah, these fairy tales provide few alternatives for self-motivated women without criticizing those traits or those powers. They issue clear warnings to, quote, rebellious women, morally censure those who exhibit cleverness, manipulative skill, will, or power. These traits are allied with things like vanity and shrewishness, ugliness, and most of the characters who exhibit these traits die gruesome fates. And so, it's not viewed as positive behaviors for viewers. It's nonconformity will result in social ostracism. That's the clear message. So it really sabotages female assertiveness, defiant self-expression. So instead, we get the pretty passive heroine whose submission to an acceptable role ensures her happiness.
And in the end, marriage is what it's all about.
Yep. and that's where we'll move right now. Most of these movies end in marriage.
And if they don't end in marriage, they end in the implication of a future marriage.
And I just want to say, for the record, marriage is a beautiful thing. Motherhood, beautiful thing. That's not what we're saying here. It's just that some of the... Let's talk about what messages we're sending our children about relationships and marriages, okay? Mm-hmm. We've already discussed it's always love at first sight with very little talking going on.
Yeah, there's frequently, I think, the first problem that happens in these movies is that the relationship between the couple who end up getting married is extremely unrealistic. They choose each other without knowing each other first. The way that they decide to be a couple is not based on anything that we would want our children or anyone we know to use. They see each other and decide it's a go. Snow White says, "To fall in love? Was it hard? It was very easy. Anyone could see that the prince was charming." And this is, she has never actually spoken to the guy. She's never been closer than 30 feet to him. And she's chosen him and fallen in love and is letting her audience know that falling in love is really easy. You just have to check him out.
And it doesn't matter what's on the inside. Again, it's that surface glance that seals it for you. There's a lot of that blind commitment going on and blind trust as well. These women barely know men in these films. And a couple of instances, for instance, in Pocahontas, Captain John Smith asks if Pocahontas trusts him. Aladdin asks Jasmine the same. They barely know each other, but the female princesses, in their eyes start sparkling. And they go, "Yes, I do trust him." And they go blindly off on this adventure. Again, a message we want to be careful about sending our daughters.
Yes.
And marriage itself, this is presented as this enchanted state.
It's the ultimate goal. It's the ending
dream
of the fairy tale.
So, you know, some of the princesses, that's all they were dreaming about all along. So, yay, they get their wish. But even the other princesses who had kind of varying dreams, in the end, those dreams vanish away or get seamlessly assimilated into this marriage proposition.
Once they find their prince, all of their goals and dreams are insignificant or turn out to be about the prince. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, Pocahontas realizes that arrow dream must have been pointing to John Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And Belle, who had talked about something more than this provincial town and adventure, well, she's got the beast in a castle instead and seems perfectly happy about it.
Talk about Stockholm Syndrome. And, you know, Mulan marries a man. Well, actually, it doesn't end in a marriage, but it's pretty much implied that she is
They're
going to
couple.
Get together with this prince who, earlier in the film, threatened to kill her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So marriage is not necessarily portrayed in a healthy and realistic manner, and I think teaches girls to be kind of obsessed with marriage and the white dress from a very early age. And this is, which we haven't actually mentioned yet, this, of course, is the conservative heterosexual vision of marriage, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily what is the right choice for all of the little girls out there who will grow up.
And even the way that marriage is depicted is very narrow, and it doesn't really allow the wife or mother then to have other avenues, other interests, dreams, etc. It's a very narrow role. So, you know, what bothers me the most about this entire discussion is how much I have internalized.
Me!
And, you know, it makes me wonder how many of us are still in some way waiting for our prince, or at least for our frog, to turn into one.
Yeah, which, you know, brings us to what do we do about it? I mean, I think that we really need to think about what messages we're giving our girls. We need to give our girls different models. We need to hear the women's voices.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're around girls, whether they're ours or not, we need to raise them to know who they are, to know what they think, to know what they want. We need to help our girls to become heroic, to become gutsy, to have ideas and opinions.
Absolutely. I mean, currently half the human population, the voices of the female population in the world are diminished or silenced. And we've got problems. We've got environmental problems and social problems, and we need those voices at the table. We need warriors. women warriors,
yeah,
to move beyond war as our only solution.
And it's so important, I think, that after we've taken a look at this, hopefully we can all go back and think about what our children are hearing, whether it's from movies or music or books that they're reading, and what the messages are that are underneath the obvious plot.
Right. Think about it. Talk to your kids about it. And I'd like to close this section of the program with a quote from Danae Cassandra in her excellent website, A Feminist Critique of Animation. She reminds us that children are in the process of identity formation. By choosing what we show our kids, we are making choices about the future, who they are to become. I want to thank you, Suzanne, for your insight and for coming into town all the way from Texas for this show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for Molly Mayo with her very first radio piece on this country's own princess icon, Miss America.
First, I just wanted to thank you guys. That was such an interesting discussion. And just like princesses, the Miss America pageant is really a culmination of multiple issues, including sexism, racism, classism, body image, advertising, and so it goes. And discussing these things is so interesting because it's a chance, you know, to crack the code and deconstruct exactly what's going on. And it's things we've internalized as well. So it's just so interesting. Just like princesses are marketed to girls, there's a very, very narrow standard of beauty that is marketed to women, and it's marketed absolutely everywhere. And the Miss America pageant, just like the Disney princess movies, says, here we are providing a positive role model for girls in Miss America for women and claiming to be about women's achievement, but it's really about perpetuating a myth that if you are good and beautiful, you can achieve. And it's the same kind of passive thing with beauty and goodness, you will be rewarded. So here is my piece about Miss America.
Although hundreds of thousands of viewers of the Miss America pageant watch it in earnest, and thousands of young women dedicate a large portion of their young adulthood toward competing for the Miss America title, my mom, my sister, and myself have an annual tradition of laughing at it. Though we're generally nice, conscientious human beings, we do allow ourselves one evening each year where we exercise our capacity to cast absolutely shallow, superficial judgments at the gals on the screen and the pageant in general. As we enjoy heckling at the pageant, we wear garish, sparkling clothing acquired from thrift stores, pass around a few tiaras, and share unusual talent acts we may or may not have rehearsed. And with all those skinny girls on stage, we always eat, preferably chocolate chip pancakes with ice cream. How is it that the Miss America pageant, on the one hand, a revered American tradition nearly 90 years old, and on the other hand, a potent symbol of a sexist society that objectifies women, cause us three so much merriment? Here's my theory. 50 individual women have been judged most fair in the land. When they all come together for the national pageant, it really is quite amazing and amusing how exactly alike they all appear. So any element of these girls that deviates from a very particular standard takes on new dimensions. When a contestant walks across stage with a stray hair wisping around on the top of her head, that one hair stands out so disproportionately, we can't take our eyes off it and we giggle like crazy. Often it's the contestants' very living qualities that seem farcical, like the enthusiasm with which they proclaim their name, state, and field of study. We are used to seeing girls like this silently displayed on beer billboards or with permanent smiles in magazines, so when they talk and move, it can be jarring. We've experienced many frenzies of laughter during talent that is inevitably imperfect. Once, during a dramatic rendition of a Broadway show tune, there were numerous close-ups of the soulful contestant singing her heart out. Unfortunately, she had apparently sucked a blue-colored throat lozenge prior to her big number, and since she opened her mouth quite wide in song, millions of viewers saw a prominent and stunning blue tongue that was comically in contrast to the mood of the piece. It was a memorable and entertaining performance.
There beauty contest and beauty contest, and then there's the Miss America competition, the glamour sweepstakes to pick the reigning beauty of them all. And this year's crop seems to be the most beauteous bevy of breathtaking beauties in decades. The Miss America title is worth more than $75,000 to the winner during the next year. She'll be worth her weight in gold. For the statistical-minded, the new Miss America checks in at 35, 23, 35. She certainly measures up to her new title.
If it seems crass to give the measurements of the winning contestant, consider one of the earlier methods of judging contestants. Points were distributed according to specific body parts. 5 points for each leg, 3 for the neck, 5 for the hips, 5 for the waist, 20 each for the boobs. All right, I don't know how they scored the boobs, but you get the idea. There was even a prototype of the ideal American girl's face drafted by Max Factor. Forehead to chin should measure 8 inches. Lips span 2 inches. Cheekbones 9 inches. Nose should protrude 2 1/4 inch. Rest assured that such overt objectification of the ideal American beauty is a thing of the past. Although Miss America used to merely be a beauty pageant, times have changed. Miss America is now, and has been for many years, a scholarship competition and charity. Go to the Miss America webpage and you will, in addition to being offered the opportunity to shop online for Miss America videos, photos, and merchandise, be asked to make a tax-deductible gift to the Miss America Scholarship Fund, a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. The website states the purpose of the Miss America organization as follows. The Miss America organization is one of the nation's leading achievement programs and the world's largest provider of scholarship assistance for young women. The website goes on to say that it offers more than $45 million in cash and scholarship assistance. The next paragraph begins, today, the Miss America organization is one of the nation's leading achievement programs as well as the world's largest provider of scholarship assistance for young women. Didn't they just say that? Are they trying to emphasize something? Scholarships have been the cornerstone of the Miss America program since 1945. So, I hope you're convinced that Miss America is a reputable charity organization dedicated to providing women with scholarships and is a far cry from a beauty pageant. And if you think that asking a medical student to wear a bikini in high heels in order to earn a merit scholarship is somehow ludicrous, well, you are out of touch with convention. From being a beauty pageant objectifying women to a scholarship competition helping women achieve professional success has not always been smooth. In 1951, Miss America Yolanda Betsby refused to wear a swimming suit, causing Catalina Swimwear to withdraw sponsorship of the pageant. Catalina went on to create the Miss USA and Miss World pageants, making it a requirement that contestants and queens wear Catalina Swimwear. Miss America 1964, Rebecca King, was actually a participant in the famous bra-burning women's lib rally that took place outside the Miss America pageant 1968. It was shortly afterward that Pepsi withdrew its sponsorship of the pageant, saying the pageant no longer represented the values of America. Of course, the biggest Miss America scandal was that surrounding Vanessa Williams in 1984, the first African-American woman ever to be coronated as Miss America, and also the only Miss America ever to be impeached. Penthouse magazine got a hold of photos Vanessa had posed for years earlier and published them without her consent. Though Vanessa was excommunicated from the hearts of millions of Miss America loyalists, photos of her naked body were eagerly snapped up by American consumers. As one fan base abandoned Miss Williams, a new fan base who admired her more privately rewarded Penthouse with $22 million, an all-time single-issue sales record.
Well, the pageant industry has branched out and certainly proved more progressive values. For example, rule number 7 of the Miss America pageant that required contestants to be in good health and of the white race was updated in the 1970s, only 20 years after Brown versus the Board of Education. And pageants such as the Miss 100% America contest, run by the Ku Klux Klan, are passé. There are pageants for all kinds of people nowadays, with 33,000 pageants and hundreds of thousands of competitors comprising a $55 billion a year industry. You should know that not every pageant is designed for the less than 1% of women who are so-called correctly proportioned, genetically endowed, appropriately underweight, and given to the pageantry mindset. And pageants are no longer only for showcasing young, available women. There are now pageants for children, too. Even 6-month-old babies compete for some titles. There's the All-American Girl Pageant, the Miss American Starlet Pageant, Dream Girls USA, the Cinderella Pageant, America's Pampered Princess Pageant, the National Preteen Pageant, Miss Teen USA, America's Perfect Teen, America's Junior Miss, Miss Teen Galaxy, and there's an onslaught of local, national, and international pageants for women, such as Cinderella International, the Miss Earth Pageant, the Miss Glow Pageant, the Miss World Pageant, and the Miss Galaxy Pageant. If you don't meet the physical qualifications for most of these pageants, and given the statistical likelihood of meeting contemporary standards of beauty, you probably don't, you will be happy to know that pageants have opened doors for diversity. Now, there is a Miss Global Petite Pageant, the National American Pageant for seniors, the North American Pageant for plus sizes over 14, Miss Wheelchair America, Pretty by Nature Pageant for the natural child, Miss Asia USA, Miss Chinatown USA, Miss Cinco de Mayo, the Black Mother-Daughter Pageant, and there are now even internet pageants, like the Miss Internet Czech Republic Pageant. Broadcast of the Miss America pageant in 1954 was at that time the biggest event in TV history, with 27 million people watching, breaking all records for TV viewership. This year's pageant, Miss America 2006, marked the first time since then that the pageant was not carried by a major TV network. Though the circumstances behind no major network wanting to carry the pageant hint that the pageant might be losing popularity, its new carrier, Country Music Television, compensated for fewer viewers by running the pageant 7 times. Here are some of the more amusing highlights of this year's pageant. Once again, the contestants looked something like quintuplets times 10, with a striking one head of curls amidst 49 heads of straightened hair. In her introduction, one contestant mispronounced her field of study, elementary education. During the swimsuit competition, a woman had unintentional bikini asymmetry. The cup on one side of her bikini was slightly ajar, coming precariously close to revealing more than she had intended. The same contestant had the misfortune of another technical difficulty. During her evening gown competition, her strapless bra was slightly exposed. Unheard of! Though I don't know how it works exactly, I've read that such problems are prevented through the use of double-sided tape and adhesive spray. At this year's pageant, we also enjoyed some off-key singing and badly choreographed dance numbers. But the real fun came with the talent acts our invited guests had brought. One guest, whose outfit revealed shapely and unshaven legs, spoke of her platform, equal access for all turkeys. She then proceeded to do a dramatic reading of a Shakespeare prologue, which she also translated into turkey talk for the inclusion of the turkey audience. A wigged, prom-dressed contestant, who claimed to be a neurosurgeon, demonstrated with visual diagrams the correct way to reinsert an eyeball that has popped out of your head.
and a 2-year-old boy who came dressed as a princess demonstrated he could shake his booty. Because we had to watch the pageant on videotape, since none of us had cable TV and country music television, we were able to fast forward through all the makeup and antidepressant commercials. Research has shown that women actually experience an immediate drop in self-esteem after being subjected to the idealized images of beauty that are pervasive in advertising and the pageant. So we limit our intake to a few hours each year. It is our annual tradition of watching, with affinity and cynicism, the Miss America pageant.
Excellent. Excellent piece, Molly.
Thank you.
I'm definitely coming to your party next year.
All right, yeah. Everyone's invited.
I couldn't go this year. I didn't have enough gowns for the costume changes, but I have a year to work on it. That was incredible and frightening. Thank you so much, Molly.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for thinking of this great topic for our Bread and Roses show.
And I want to thank you again, Suzanne Marie Fanger, for being our resident expert on preschool-age girls and how all of these societal forces are trickling down to our youngest members of society.
Glad to be here.
I want to also thank our Bread and Roses engineer, Chris. Thank you very much. And also, I need to thank Jennifer Ertz Wyatt, who created the original artwork to accompany our program guide information piece. And to see more of Jennifer Ertz Wyatt's artwork, check out her website, owensays.com. That's owensays.com. I also would like to thank Bread and Roses Collective member Brooke Kavanaugh and KBOO staffer Rabia Yeaman for helping us record our demented promo that has probably been annoying all of you all week long.
Thank you, and help with my piece. Thank you so much.
Yes. It is a true collective here. If you're a woman and you'd like to get involved, don't hesitate.
We're a collection of princesses.
And it's collective in every sense of the word. It's the real thing. So please get in touch with us and join this exciting group. Another collective member, Crystal, is traveling to Washington, D.C. this weekend for a Code Pink vigil, Mothers Calling for Peace, and to bring the troops back home. She'll be working on peace to be presented on her next show on June 2nd, so be sure to tune in for that. I understand there are also local vigils this weekend in Portland and Eugene, etc. Most importantly, I need to say Happy Mother's Day to my mom and my grandmother, if you're listening.
Happy Mother's Day, Grammy, and Happy Mother's Day, Mumsy.
And Happy Mother's Day to my mother from Leanne and I.
Yeah, you're my second mom, so Happy Mother's Day to you. I want to thank everybody for listening, and don't forget to call your mom this weekend. And now Zap Mama is going to take us into our Friday night with Miss Queen.
Princess, when I try to be this princess.